I think it tells you that obviously there's a tremendous amount of tensions. This is going to be a bumpy ride. This is not a negotiation between two college roommates and they're trying to sort something out. This is a negotiation between two countries that have defined each other as lethal enemies for 47 years. And as a result, it is going to be quite eventful.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to The Corbett Report. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you in July of 2026 with a conversation with Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's an expert on U.S.-Iranian relations, Iranian foreign policy, and the geopolitics of the Middle East. He's the author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, as well as Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. More recently, he is the author of a couple of articles that we're going to talk about today. One, Why Iran Believes Israel Will Attack Again Before October, and the other, Israel Belongs in the New Saudi-Iranian Order. And of course, the links to all of that will be in the show notes, as always, but let's bring him on the program. Trita Parsi, thank you very much for joining us today on The Corbett Report.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start, since this is your first time on The Corbett Report, let's start with just an introduction about yourself and your background, your bona fides. How do you know so much about Iranian-American relations?
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you. I'm Trita Parsi. I'm the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute. Prior to that, I was the president of the National Iranian-American Council. I have been working on this issue and on Middle East politics for 25 plus years, ranging from the U.S. Congress to the U.N. Security Council to these different NGOs outside our government that I've been working on or through. I've written several books, three of them on U.S.-Iran relations, and particularly the U.S.-Iran-Israel triangle. You mentioned one of them, Treacherous Alliance. And as of late, been primarily focused on the work that we're doing at the Quincy Institute, which is a still relatively new think tank that pushes for a completely different grand strategy for the United States, one that is called restraint, and that is not, you know, essentially the opposite of this liberal hegemony approach that the United States has had for the last couple of decades.
Excellent. Well, I hope people will check into your previous work because you've been talking about this for decades. I've been listening to you on the Scott Horden program and others, so I appreciate the work that you've been doing. But let's get into the latest developments. And going back to that article I mentioned, Why Iran Believes Israel Will Attack Again Before October, which starts by noting that will Israel restart the war with Iran before the October elections? This is the consensus view emerging within Iran's internal national security debate over the past week. And obviously, this article came out about a week ago. First of all, tell us about the details of this and then update us as to what the latest thinking on this is.
Yeah, so this is an article that I put up on my Substack, treataparsi.substack.com. Welcome anyone to follow it there. And it is based on conversations I've had with folks on all sides of this issue. And the Iranians were, at least, I don't know if it's changed in the last couple of days, but they were really coming to a conclusion that the Israelis are very likely, if not a certainty, that they will attack again before October, and in their view, even sooner than that. The two things that really drive them towards this conclusion is, first of all, the Israeli-Lebanese MOU, because that one does not require Israel to leave Lebanese territory. It requires it to happen if Hezbollah is disarmed, which is not going to happen. And if it happens, it means that there will be a civil war in Lebanon. And this means that the Israelis will remain in places in Lebanon right now that are of crucial importance to Hezbollah. Hezbollah held those positions back in February. And because it held those positions, it actually played a very significant role in the war in a manner that has not been reported because of Israel's military censorship. They were able to strike at Israel from a short distance, and this is part of the reason why the Iranians did not strike at Israel as much as they could have, which raised eyebrows at the time. People were asking themselves why they're hitting the UAE so hard and not the Israelis. But part of the reason for that was because Hezbollah was very active, but none of that was really reported because of Israel's military censorship. Now, Hezbollah cannot play that role any longer because Israel has taken over those positions. And thanks to the Israeli-Lebanese agreement, it will continue to hold those positions. And this has then fueled suspicions on the Iranian side that this is done specifically because the Israelis are planning to strike at Iran again, but now from a more advantageous position, at least when you're looking at this variable, and that it will happen soon, but no later than October, because in October is, of course, the Israeli elections. And for Netanyahu, this is very crucial. He has fared very badly as of late because the MOU was a huge setback for him and for Israel. The Israelis are criticizing him from all directions, saying that he pushed for a war that ended up being a failure. And particularly if the United States now essentially accepts Lebanon's or Hezbollah's position within Lebanon, that would be a huge setback for the Israelis. So he has all of the incentives to try to reverse this. And it's not just about the electoral issue. It's the fact that if he loses his position as prime minister, he also loses his immunity. And that means that the corruption charges against him will go forward and he may very well end up in jail. So he has personal, strategic, political reasons to do this. And this is what has convinced the Iranians that Israel is very likely to attack again. They don't know, however, if this is something that the Israelis would do together with or in defiance of the United States. That part of it is something they don't have a clear conclusion on because they don't have clear data on that.
But the Americans certainly have left the door open for that, given recent comments, for example, from Vice President J.D. Vance talking about this as being an opportunity to replenish global oil reserves and see where the hand is, which suggests, at any rate, they're leaving open the possibility of continued violence.
Well, at a minimum, it fuels the Iranian suspicion that this is a scenario that the U.S. might actually be favorable towards. But I think it's important to take that statement and analyze it from several different directions. One can certainly draw the conclusion that this suggests that the United States is not serious about Plan A, which is the MOU, and that this is just a cover in order to be able to restart the war after the elections, after they have replenished oil stockpiles, et cetera, et cetera. But one can also look at it a different way and pointing out that it is extremely unlikely that the United States or Iran would go into this diplomatic process with only a plan A, that they would naturally have a plan B in place as well, and probably a plan B, a C, and a plan D as well. I would be shocked if the Iranians don't have the same thing, because at the end of the day, both sides know that the prospects of getting a deal is not guaranteed in any way, shape, or form, but I would put it at less than 50%. So obviously, you have to have a plan A, B. The question is, did this statement in any way, shape, or form reveal or suggest that the actual plan A is the plan B, meaning that the plan B is the plan A, that you know the MOU and the diplomacy is just a fake plan? I'm not convinced of that. I understand that this is one way one can interpret it. I am certain that the Iranians will look at it that way, or they will be gravitating towards looking at it that way. But when you just take a look at the realities on the ground, yes, if you were to want to restart the war, you would want to replenish oil stockpiles. But I think it's very important to recognize that by happenstance, when the war started, oil inventory was actually very high. And we still had this disastrous result. So it's not as if we're going to go to a scenario in which the oil inventory will be much better than it was at the beginning of this war. Secondly, you're going to have repercussions of this war still being felt, and some of them not yet being felt, even after the elections, because there are several third and fourth degree consequences that are not going to be felt until later. So we're going to then start a war on roughly the same circumstances, at least when it comes to oil, but now with additional pressures on the global economy that have not yet been felt. And thirdly, if the United States actually had a military option that had a high likelihood of success within a short time frame, then the United States would be using that right now. There's no reason to wait till after the elections. Rather than to go into these elections with this criticized diplomatic process that is very strenuous and is prone to criticism, you know, you would just use your military option and walk into the midterm elections with a military victory. So looking at it and looking at the broader circumstances, I'm not convinced that that statement was a revelation of a desire to not be serious about diplomacy, not actually invest heavily in the MOU. But I think it was essentially a revelation that obviously the US has a plan B, so do the Iranians. And I'm sure there's a plan C and a plan D as well.
So what is your take on the progress or lack thereof of negotiations between Iran and US so far?
Well, I think, you know, we're seeing a tremendous amount of pressure being put on these negotiations. The fact that there even was an exchange of fire between the United States and Iran for more than 48 hours is obviously terrible. But on the other hand, it didn't kill the diplomatic activities, which is quite astonishing. I think it tells you that obviously there's a tremendous amount of tensions. This is going to be a bumpy ride. This is not a negotiation between two college roommates and they're trying to sort something out. This is a negotiation between two countries that have defined each other as lethal enemies for 47 years. And as a result, it is going to be quite eventful. The fact, though, that it has survived that exchange of fire, which I hope never happens again, because who knows if it can survive a second one or a third one. But the fact that it survived one, I think, is an indication of how strong the desire nevertheless is on both sides for a negotiated settlement out of the reality that they neither side of them actually have a good scenario. They're not going to face a good scenario if there isn't a deal. So both of them are pushed in this direction by the realities on the ground.
Well, let's talk about your latest article then. It's up on foreignpolicy.com under the headline, Israel Belongs in the New Saudi-Iranian Order, with the subhead, An Anti-Abraham Accords is Taking Shape. That would be a big mistake. And the article starts, when Iran expanded the Israeli-American war by striking Persian Gulf Arab states, many observers assumed this new low in Iran-Gulf Cooperation Council, GCC, relations would endure for years and drive Arab states closer to Israel. Tehran's escalation seemed to validate Israel's argument that the Gulf monarchies needed to align with it against their common Persian threat. Instead, the opposite appears to be unfolding. So tell us about that, that interesting situation.
Yeah, so I, as you know, oftentimes you don't get to pick the title of the article, and the title is not the one I would have chosen. I don't think it fully captures what I was trying to say in this deal, but in this piece. But I essentially make three points in this foreign policy article. One is exactly what you mentioned, that instead of seeing the region gravitating towards the US and Israel, we're seeing the opposite. They're realizing that the containment of Iran ultimately was unsuccessful and ended in a disastrous war. As a result, going forward, however difficult it may be, however emotionally challenging it may be for many of them, they need to find a new balance in which, on the one hand, they do try to counter some of Iran's activities and power, but on the other hand, also from a security standpoint, recognize the importance of economic integration and interdependence with Iran. Essentially taking a page out of the European playbook pre-2022 and post-World War II, in which the Europeans really sought to integrate Germany economically in order to make it as difficult and as costly as possible to ever have another world war in Europe. And it was a tremendously successful strategy, the steel and coal union that eventually led to the European Union. That's the direction the GCC states, most of them are going right now, which we're trying to, from a security standpoint, try to integrate Iran economically. So this is a huge shift. And the second point I'm making is that this is the opposite of what Washington has predicted for a long time, because Washington has constantly believed that if the US were to step back from the region, if the US were no longer to be the ultimate security guarantor for the region would descend into collapse. Whereas we on the restraint side have argued if the US steps back, it will actually incentivize regional states to step forward, take responsibility for their own security, do the burden shifting that we need on the American side, and in the sense of having these regional states that are extremely wealthy, cover the expenses of their own security instead of their falling on the shoulders of the American taxpayers or American servicemen and women. So I think it's yet another validation of the fact that the restrainers have been right on what would happen if the US actually were to start pulling back from the region. The third point, I think, though, is the most important one, which is to argue that while this is, in my view at least, very positive, it's fantastic that they're giving up on this idea of just isolating Iran. It doesn't work. It's great that they're going for some sort of a new security architecture that does take the burden of security away from the U.S., off on U.S. shoulders. But if it is done in a manner that just replaces Israel with Iran, meaning that Iran gets decontained and Israel gets recontained, then we're not seeing the type of a transformation of the region that I think is necessary. Instead, we're just seeing a shifting of the fault lines. Israel is now on the outside while Iran is being brought back in. And I do point out that obviously Israel deserves isolation and a lot of pressure given what it is doing in the region, the destabilizing activities, its territorial expansion, and of course the genocide that it is conducting in Gaza. But at the end of the day, I don't believe that isolation alone will work, just as it didn't work with the Iranians. And I argue for something that we at the Better Order Project that Quincy have put forward, which is a proposal that essentially marries the idea of the establishment of an all-inclusive security architecture in the region with an open door for the Israelis to be able to join that architecture so it is truly inclusive. But the ticket price for Israel is a Palestinian state based on 1967 lines, meaning that the Israelis can join, but only if they actually end this illegal occupation, adhere to the ICJ rulings and UNGA resolutions on this matter. And if they're willing to do so, they should be included. Now, of course, I recognize and I write about it in the piece, it is highly unrealistic right now, but it isn't for now. Because it's going to take 5 to 10 years to build this security architecture. It is to make sure that the door is theoretically kept open for the Israelis. And the region should continue on its own, build its own security architecture without the Israelis until the Israelis are ready. But it would be a mistake, in my view, not to take advantage of this moment in which the region is really willing to step up and take responsibility for matters and only have it resolve the Persian Gulf security issue, which is the exclusion of Iran, without addressing a broader source of instability in the region, which is Israel's continued and illegal occupation of Palestine. I think it would be a missed opportunity if this was not done.
What you say, it makes total logical sense. And I'll throw in the link to the Better Order Project, betterorderproject.org, so people can find out more about that. And there's no doubt that if everyone at the table was a logical player, just looking at this rationally, I think that something like that type of regional security architecture would develop. But obviously, we do not live in such a world. And of course, I'd say what is stated for the public consumption versus what these different players are actually trying to achieve tend to be different. And I think we'd have to be extremely naive at this point in order to believe that Israel is just looking for make sure the region doesn't, the regional enemies aren't too aggressive against Israel. Whereas, of course, I think that obviously Israel is trying to be the dominant player in the region at whatever cost. And that's why we see these multiple wars that they're engaged in. How do we cross that bridge from what the sort of the public ideal of what diplomacy is about versus what is actually happening here?
First of all, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, when I write this, I'm fully aware that a lot of people will immediately accuse me of being naive or saying that, you know, it's a good idea, but it's just not going to work. Fully understand that. But I think we have to understand that certain things like this also looked increasingly and unimaginably naive back in 1945. But the Europeans, who had been fighting two world wars in half a century, were butchering each other in ways that the Middle Easterners never have, nevertheless managed to transition away from the previous conception of security to a collective security concept, precisely because they realized they just could not afford to continue to butcher each other that way. In fact, so much of what we have in international law and norms that have been formed in the last half a century come in this period precisely because people remembered the absolute horrors of the scale of that war. And it is that actually gave birth to something that otherwise would have been naive. And the question is, have the Middle East experienced enough of it now, particularly after this war, to be willing to take that step? And reality, they are taking these steps right now. They are. I mean, if you had asked me 5 years ago, a lot of people would have said, oh, there's no way the Middle Eastern countries are going to take a step towards their own security architecture. It's just not going to happen. It's increasingly naive, and it's happening right now. In fact, as I write in the piece, one of the meetings is supposed to be happening in Riyadh, meaning that the Saudis are on board, which is crucial given how important Saudi Arabia is for the region's geopolitics. So a lot of things that previously were unimaginable are starting to become imaginable at a faster pace than people thought. And it's precisely that reason as to why I think it would be an error not to think big enough and not use this moment to also do justice to the Palestinian people who have a right to self-determination and have a right for statehood. Because otherwise, we're going to see an architecture being built. It will be less naive because it will not try to include Israel, but at the same time, as a result, will probably not do anything to be able to address the situation of the Palestinians who continue to suffer under this occupation. So again, I recognize that this is something that is difficult to think is realistic right now, but I think it's important to recognize that the world is changing so fast that we have to have a more flexible understanding of what could become realistic just in a year or in 5 years. Let me add one more point to it. Who would have thought that the politics of the United States right now would be such that both on the left and on the right, Israel is so tremendously unpopular that incumbents are losing left and right their primaries because of their support for Israel. And that you have legislation...
With the notable exception of Thomas Massie.
With the notable exception of Thomas Massie, in which they put more than $30 million, which is not something they can do in each and every one of those races. So in some ways, Thomas got a little bit unlucky there because they chose to focus on him and as a result could not focus on some of these other races. And when that amount of money is not in play, we see what the results end up being. So the politics of this is changing in a dramatic way as well that, again, 5 years ago would have been completely unimaginable. Now, you raise a question, though, as to, you know, does it mean that the Israelis want this? The entire piece is premised on the idea that the Israelis will not want this until they are deprived of the options of being able to continue to what they're doing right now, which is based on the U.S. no longer being supportive of them in the manner that the U.S. has, giving them a complete carte blanche, but also because changes can happen in Israeli society if they actually see that something concrete is available, it is being built, it is functioning, and they're left outside, but there is an open door for them. So, for instance, the logic behind the Abraham Accords, which I completely reject, and I think it was an idiotic idea, should never have been done, and it is absolutely shameful that the Biden administration made it the center point of their Middle East foreign policy, which is part of the reason why they ended up supporting Israel in the genocide. But part of the reasoning behind it was that Israeli society would shift away from some of these expansionist policies if they realized that normalization with Saudi Arabia was in the cards. But normalization with Saudi Arabia is such an abstract thing. It really doesn't tell you what it means. That this proposal is completely different. It says build a security architecture, have this formal organization in place, have these quarterly meetings between all of these different foreign ministers and defense ministers. Let the Israelis see this for 5-7 years and know that there is something concrete there. And their inclusion is then as a result, no longer this conceptual, academic, theoretical thing. They can actually see what it would mean and to see whether that would have a change in the Israeli politics away from this very radical direction that they have been going on towards in the last, well, at least for the last 2 decades, I would say.
Well, obviously, another major factor in this is the U.S. and what it ultimately ends up deciding to do or not do in the region and the way that other regional partners and players are looking at the U.S. and its supposed umbrella, obviously, which has come into question given the events that we've just seen unfold in this past conflict. So one aspect of that we just saw reported from the cradle, Saudi Crown Prince lost confidence in Trump after U.S. failure in Iran, talking about some of the tensions that have apparently arisen between Washington and Riyadh over military posturing and action in the region. What is the U.S.'s role in this? What is it likely to be going forward? And what would it be if such a security architecture as the one you're proposing came for, to pass?
Well, I think, again, part of the reason that you're seeing these regional countries, including Saudi Arabia, going towards some sort of a security architecture of their own is precisely because they realize that the American security umbrella is increasingly unreliable and ineffective. In fact, its stunning limitations were demonstrated as a result of this war. Prior to this war, everyone thought that it would have been much more effective than it actually was. And then on top of that, a loss of confidence in American decision-making. Many of these states had warned the United States what would have happened if it started this war. In the case of Saudi Arabia, it actually seems to be a little bit more complex. It seems like the Saudis actually were pushing, at least MBS was pushing for this war, but he, of course, thought that the U.S. would be much more effective in defeating the Iranians than the U.S. was. But nevertheless, all of this has led to a scenario in which all of them have to look out for their own interests, and that necessitates not breaking with the U.S., but no longer deferring to the U.S., and diversifying their own security baskets to make sure that all of their eggs are no longer in just the American one. And again, this is actually something that we in the United States should be welcoming. Because if it means that they're no longer relying on the United States for a security umbrella, then the United States no longer has to have 19 or so bases in the region and 50,000 troops in peacetime there. And we've heard presidential candidate after presidential candidate say, I'm going to bring our servicemen and women home from the Middle East. Well, here's the opportunity to do so, because the two key forces that kept the U.S. in the region, several different forces. First of all, was the Israelis. They do not want to see the United States leave. They want the U.S. to be there present as strongly as possible because it tilts the regional balance in their favor. But also many of the other U.S. allies, the GCC states, even though they didn't see eye to eye with Israel, they definitely wanted to keep the U.S. there. And that was because they were pursuing and they were favoring the sanctions, the isolation policy of Iran. But now you have a scenario in which the GCC states are integrating with Iran. They don't want the United States, they're not breaking with the U.S., but they don't need the bases any longer because the bases turn out to be quite useless. Magnets for attacks rather than deterrence. So the forces that were actually keeping the U.S. there are changing dramatically at this point. And this gives the United States a fantastic opportunity to withdraw while at the same time being able to support this effort for the region to build its own architecture. That ensures that the American withdrawal will not necessarily lead to any chaos or instability, but rather it could actually be a rather peaceful transition of responsibility.
Well, finally, Trita, obviously you know, and I'm sure many people in my audience know, in this morally inverted world in which we're living, the act of talking about peace and pathways to peace can be a dangerous activity that might make you a thought criminal with certain players in the establishment. And of course, we saw the reports last month from a number of outlets like this one from NewRepublic.com. Trump team investigates how to deport major Iran war critic. The State Department is reportedly targeting Trita Parsi. Tell us about this. Are you a thought criminal about to be deported from the United States? What's happening?
I probably am a thought criminal. It would be quite an insult if I wasn't a thought criminal. But it turns out that, at least as far as I know, that there never was such an investigation. There was an attempt by some very influential people to initiate an investigation, but there was a massive pushback against it. And the State Department itself came out and denied that there was an investigation or that they had any intent to deport me. I don't believe that those people, you know, essentially they are the ones who are favoring more wars, favoring the United States, you know, doing whatever the Israeli government asks us to. They've been gunning for me for more than 20 years. They definitely have escalated their efforts as of late. And I think they will continue. I just saw that earlier today, Laura Loomer once again tweeted and urged for my deportation. And I'm sure that she will continue to do so for quite some time. But this is the unfortunate reality of the level of debate in the United States today. Again, if they had any arguments that could win the American people to their side, I'm sure they would be using it. They don't. And as a result, all they can do is to issue threats, defamation, slander, and go forward with that. And for some time, that actually was effective. It did create a lot of problems. But I think we've reached a tipping point, going back to what I said earlier on, of how fast the politics around Israel is changing in this country, in which these type of attacks, while problematic and still costly, nevertheless, do not have the same potency as they once did.
Well, hats off to you for continuing to speak out, even in the face of such adversity, and for continuing to do your work. For people who are interested in following that work, both you specifically and the Quincy Institute in general, how can they go about doing that?
They can go to my Substack, which is treetuparsi.substack.com, go to Twitter, which is @tparsi, and of course, go to the Quincy Institute's website, which is quincyinst.org.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate the updates today, and I hope this will not be our last opportunity to talk. I'd like to have updates.
Happy to do it again. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We all know the story of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda.
Bin Laden was responsible for today's attack.
So often was that story repeated in the wake of 9/11 that the hypnotized public forgot that it was, at base, just that, a story.
If they didn't have an Osama bin Laden out there, they'd invent one.
In False Flags, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda, you will learn the truth behind that story and uncover the lies that led to the War of Terror.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there.
Watch the documentary for free at corbettreport.com/Al-Qaeda, or support the filmmaker and purchase the documentary on DVD at newworldnextweek.com.